Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast and audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about a family cursed with a history of mental illness and hereditary blindness. It's a strange relationship where their condition both united and divided them. But with sexual abuse potentially added into the mix, it would lead to a brutal and horrifying murder. Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds. So that, no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 152. Blind Obsession. Today, I'm standing somewhere in the borough of Hammersmith and Fulham in West London. Possibly outside a flat above Ashcroft Square in Hammersmith, W6. But none of this can be verified, as most of the details were never published and many were redacted. If so, we're streets from the home of one of John Monckton's killers, the garage where the first aid killer pulled up with Kate Beagley's body in the boot, the house where schoolgirl Katerina Konyeva died at the hands of the beast, and not far from the obsessions of Winston Goulbourn. Coming soon to Murder Mile. It is often said that some stories are never meant to be told, as there are deep dark secrets that exist in a family which no one would dare to discuss until someone steps over the line of what is right and wrong. This is a case which did not appear on the TV news, and it barely made it into any papers. Which is why, at times, the details may be vague, and many statements cannot be independently verified. A detailed report by the Mental Health Trust provided a fascinating insight into the life of the young woman involved. And although she was only ever referred to as Ms. T, we know her name was Maria Calero. What follows is some of her story. The date was Sunday the 17th of June 2007. It was early morning at roughly 3 a.m. And as for the exact location, that was never disclosed. But it was probably a flat somewhere off Ashcroft Square. From an upstairs window, two unidentified boys, aged 12 and 13, attracted the attention of a passerby having been locked inside their bedroom. With no smoke, alarms, nor screams, this could have been a prank. Only the children were in a state of panic. Not in fear for themselves, but for someone else. The police were called, and concerned for the boys' welfare, they gained entry. Physically, they were unharmed. But mentally, they had been through an ordeal, having heard a man being cruelly tortured. On the floor lay their father, Eduardo, slumped in a cold, motionless puddle of his own blood. His walls and doors were spattered red, as a kitchen knife and a set of scissors had ceaselessly severed his veins and arteries. As across his once clean carpet, the sticky shadows of his bloodied handprints lay where this terrified man had dragged his body far from his assailants, leaving a long red trail like a dying slug. It was a brutal murder by someone with a lot of hatred in their heart. An attack so sustained that if it began right now, it wouldn't end until this episode stops. Three people were arrested for his death: his niece, his nephew, and his brother. But proving who the culprit was would be problematic, as with the children locked in the bedroom, they saw very little. One of the accused would claim, "I did not take part in the murder." The other said, "I didn't kill because I couldn't see." And with all three suspects either partially sighted or almost entirely blind, that could be true. Only there was one who saw everything. A reliable eyewitness who could replay every second, every stab, and every slash of the murder, and recount it in a court of law with irrefutable detail and accuracy. But that is for the end. So let's go back to where this all began. Referred to in the report only as Ms. T, Maria Calero was born in 1986 in the South American country of Peru, with her brother Richard born 1 year later. The circumstances of their plight was unknown. But following a brutal conflict in their homeland, although their father Ricardo remained behind, 6-year-old Maria, 5-year-old Richard, and their mother sought asylum in the UK in 1992. It made sense, as their mother's brother, Uncle Eduardo, was living in a West London flat with his wife, his daughter, and soon to be pregnant with the first of their two sons. Although Maria's mother had very little to call her own, what she did have was a close-knit family for when times got tough. In April 1993, Maria's mother's mental health deteriorated as her immigration status remained uncertain. And against medical advice that she needed to be fully assessed, she discharged herself from hospital. A few days later, this lone woman stood on London Bridge, looking across the dark and murky waters of the raging River Thames. In her arms, she held all that she loved, her children. Clutching them tight and kissing their heads, seeing this drastic measure as her only way out, she hurled both children off the bridge, herself following behind, as they plunged 30 feet to a certain death at this known suicide spot. Quick-thinking passers-by called the police, a nearby marine patrol was dispatched, and all three were rescued. The fall should have killed them, and the water should have drowned them. But thankfully, their physical injuries weren't critical. Their mother had a fractured spine. Richard suffered face and elbow abrasions, and Maria had fractured her pelvis. In time, they would all make a good recovery, but the psychological scars would never heal. In February 1994, Maria's father Ricardo came to England seeking asylum. And given the fragility of his wife's mental state, he was assessed as the protective parent of Maria and Richard. Earning a living as a dental assistant, he supported the family while his wife sought the help she so badly needed. Maria and Richard witnessed their mother's mania on a regular basis. Her outbursts, her threats, and her suicide attempts. In one, she sliced up her wrists. In another, she took an overdose of pills. And again, she would try to destroy those that she loved the most. In 1995, when Maria was only aged 11, her mother tried to drown her in a bath of water. For their safety, both children were placed on the Child Protection Register. They were put into foster care, and Maria and her brother received child therapy from a Spanish-speaking therapist. The abuse she suffered made Maria feel unloved and vulnerable, and she struggled to form healthy relationships with her family. In 1998, when Maria was 12, her mother fled the family. Their relationship was torturous, so this breakup should have been a moment for Maria to rediscover herself. But having been bounced from foster homes to temporary housing to living with her uncle, her daughter, and his two sons, Maria's early years were incredibly unstable, especially as this young girl entered a hormonally charged puberty. Life was hard, and although times were bad, for all of the Calero family, it was about to get worse. That same year, Maria's father Ricardo was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, a rare genetic disorder where the light-sensitive tissues in the retina aggressively degenerate, making even the simplest of tasks, whether reading, walking, or recognizing faces, difficult without assistance. Within the year, her father would be completely blind. And although his vision meant this family lost their main income, this diagnosis came with a very terrifying footnote. Retinitis pigmentosa is hereditary. By the turn of the millennium, Maria's home life was a mess. Her mother was back, and her father was blind. So when she wasn't in foster care, she found sanctuary in her uncle's flat, just off Ashcroft Square. 2 years earlier, Uncle Eduardo had separated from his wife, but stayed in the small flat with his two sons and their older sister. It seemed like a stable place for his niece to escape to. But depending on whose story you choose to believe, Maria and Eduardo had a very strange bond. One of love and hate. That same year, age 14, Maria locked herself inside her uncle's flat and refused to come out. This makes some sense, as this hormonal teenager had made allegations of bullying and abuse against her mother. Later in 2000, Maria claimed that her uncle had abused her. A social worker investigated the allegation, but no action was taken. And having absconded from foster care, Maria returned to stay at her uncle's flat. Again, that same year, she alleged that her uncle had sexually assaulted her, an accusation backed up by her parents and some of her uncle's children. Both the police and child services were involved, but no action was taken, as often she would deny that the assault took place, or entirely withdrew the allegation. And yet, it is said that being unable to maintain a healthy relationship within her family, she continued in a sexual relationship with her uncle Eduardo, as finding very little love elsewhere, she feared his rejection. In February 2001, Maria's parents alleged further inappropriate behavior by her uncle. A complaint was made to Child Services, but as both Maria and Eduardo denied this, again, no action could be taken. Rightfully, the police criticized Child Services for allowing this minor to sleep over at her uncle's while an allegation of sexual assault was pending. But they were powerless to take action. So with no foster carer at that time, a social worker was assigned to monitor Maria while she stayed with her uncle. But there's only so much monitoring a social worker can do from a distance. In July 2001, another official allegation of child sexual abuse was made against Uncle Eduardo and his now 15-year-old niece. This time, by his own daughter. Having fled, she told the police she was afraid to go home, having seen Maria and Eduardo on the sofa. He was shirtless and putting on his trousers. Again, the allegations were denied by both, and being powerless to proceed, no charges were made. Allegations and denials flew thick and fast, and with the system designed to protect Maria seen as both helpless and hopeless, her parents took matters into their own hands. They smashed his car windows and assaulted him in the street. It did nothing, and it resolved nothing, except to vent their frustrations. Only the stresses and strains of this fractured family were piling on top of Maria. By February 2002, concerns were raised about Maria's mental health, having been diagnosed with an adjustment disorder with dissociative symptoms. She had cut off all her hair, she had dropped out of school, and she had told her child therapist how unloved she felt, stating, "Even my spit isn't worth anything." And having become agoraphobic, she had become virtually housebound, living inside her uncle's flat. 2 years later, Child Services had to remove Maria from the flat, following allegations that her uncle had punched one of his preteen sons in the face. Right then, the council had proved that it had the power to protect a child from abuse. But for Maria, it was too little, too late. As by September 2004, she had turned 18. Officially an adult, the care order had ended between Hammersmith and Fulham Children's Services, but she was transferred under the authority of the Adult Mental Health Services, as Maria had complex needs. Her mental decline was understandable given her chaotic upbringing. Nobody could hope to come out unscathed, given what she had seen, what she had heard, and what she had experienced. Truancy, depression, anxiety, isolation, infighting, with allegations of physical assaults and sexual abuse, which although unproven, could easily be real, as well as her own mother's attempts to kill herself and Maria, once in a bath as a child, and once having thrown her off London Bridge. It's no surprise that Maria lacked trust. She felt no love, she was full of anger, and she suffered with bouts of anxiety and depression. And yet, a psychiatrist would state that she had no major mental illness and no medication was required. To those who knew her, Maria's mental health was in rapid decline. But this wasn't just because of her past, as one very specific aspect of her future had been plaguing her mind for almost a decade. In the summer of 2006, Maria was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, the same hereditary condition which had taken her father's sight. And given how fast her vision had degenerated, her prognosis was not good. Specialists had confirmed that within the year, she too would be almost entirely blind. Weighing heavy on her spiraling mental health, Maria admitted to a psychiatrist that as the once bright world around her became ever darker, burning feelings of anger had begun to swell inside her. As she became more impulsive, anxious, and started to experience hallucinations. In November 2006, she was prescribed the antidepressant sertraline. As like her mother before her, she had expressed suicidal thoughts, as well as deep feelings of aggression towards others, especially her uncle. In less than 1 year, Maria Calero would brutally stab Uncle Eduardo to death in a sustained torture in his Hammersmith flat, which would leave his two teenage sons traumatized. But who was the victim at that point? And why wasn't the alleged abuse stopped? Unable to restrain her bubbling rage, Maria had assaulted her mother and admitted to a psychiatrist her desire to stab and blind her uncle. Born on the maternal line, Eduardo was not affected by this family curse. But regardless of whether her hatred for him was fueled by the abuse she had allegedly suffered, or, if you take the other side, as he had rejected her love, Maria wished blindness upon him. The psychologist was so concerned that he wrote to Eduardo, making him aware of Maria's desires to do him harm. And although her parents openly attacked him, claiming he raped their daughter, Maria returned to her uncle's flat. To say that their relationship was confusing would be an understatement. Crippled with depression, anxiety, and with the last vestiges of her vision rapidly deteriorating to the point where even the simplest of tasks had become impossible without assistance, Maria became reclusive. A shut-in at Uncle Eduardo's flat, and almost entirely reliant on him for food, clothes, and prescriptions. With her mind plagued with thoughts of self-harm and aggression, as was her prerogative, she stopped seeing her therapist. She ignored the calls from her social worker, and she often failed to take her medication. Having isolated herself inside her uncle's flat, her anxieties and delusions only got worse. She would claim that voices would talk to her in the middle of the night, and sometimes she said she saw the faces too. Whether real or imaginary, she became even more distressed as her uncle's sons mocked her. That her and Eduardo's relationship had descended into frequent verbal fights. And again, she talked about ending it all. And although she had threatened to harm her uncle, her words soon turned into wounds. On the morning of Friday the 15th of June 2007, just 2 days before, Maria called her social worker to confess, "I've stabbed my uncle," and repeated her allegation that he had raped her 7 years earlier. In an incident which erupted when he allegedly started to wind her up by threatening to bring his own daughter from Peru and, in his words, to make your life hell. Maria stated, "I felt rage. Then I stabbed him in the back with a knife." But was this assault fueled by anger, jealousy, or rejection? Assessed at the A&E of Charing Cross Hospital, Eduardo covered for his niece by claiming it was a work-related injury, having fallen backwards onto a sharp metal tool. He was treated and discharged. Accompanied by her care worker, Maria reiterated her story at Hammersmith Police Station and later to the Sapphire Unit in Fulham for further investigation, and she returned home. But not to her uncle's flat. This time, to her parents. On Sunday the 17th of June 2007, at roughly 2:30 a.m, in what is believed to be a two-floor flat at the Ashcroft Square complex above the King's Mall, stood Maria, her brother Richard, and her father Ricardo. Exactly what happened may remain as vague as their vision. As with all three virtually blind and often helpless without some assistance, the details of the night are shrouded in a thick fog of confusion and allegations. How and when they got into the flat is unknown. Maybe they had a key, maybe they broke in, or maybe they were let in on the ruse of this fractured family making peace. But at some point, Eduardo's boys were locked inside their bedroom, and the real reason for the visit would come out. The torture of Uncle Eduardo was slow and protracted. Clutching a kitchen knife and a set of scissors, Maria plunged and pierced each blade into his flesh. Screaming at the top of her lungs, "He raped me. He raped me." An allegation she had both repeatedly admitted and denied over the last 7 years. Seeking revenge for a rape only he or she would know was true. Over the next 24 minutes, she would stab and slash the uncle she both loved and hated a total of 111 times. An attack so sustained, if it began at the beginning of this episode, it still wouldn't have stopped. in his last few moments alive, Uncle Eduardo pleaded for his life. And although his terrified sons heard every second of their father's brutal murder, having flagged down a passerby, the police were alerted, the flat was sealed off, and all three members of the Calero family were arrested. The evidence was irrefutable. The blood, the knife, the scissors, and the testimony of what the boys had heard. But with all three suspects either visually impaired or totally blind, as one had claimed, I did not take part in the murder, and the other, I didn't kill because I couldn't see. How could this be proven? It was simple. Unable to fully see what they were doing, whether to aid the attack or as a sick souvenir of Maria's revenge, Richard had filmed the entire murder on his mobile phone. Every second, every stab, and every slash of Eduardo's demise, which could be recounted in court as an irrefutable fact. So shocking was the footage that many jurors needed counselling over what they had seen and heard. But in that flat, that night, those 24 minutes of footage was the only reliable eyewitness. Eduardo Mendoza was transferred to St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington, but was pronounced dead on arrival owing to blood loss and shock. Richard, Ricardo, and Maria Calero were arrested on the charge of murder. With Maria sobbing as she was led away from the crime scene, the voices made me do it. But if this was true, which voices made her commit murder? The angry ones or the jealous ones? Ricardo and Richard were held in custody to await their appearance at West London Magistrates Court. Having been assessed at Shepherd's Bush Police Station, suspecting that Maria was hallucinating, she was held under Section 2 of the Mental Health Act and later transferred to a mental health hospital. So distraught was Maria's mother, upon hearing the news of her brother's murder at the hands of her own husband, son, and daughter, that again, Mrs. Calero took her own life. Only this time, she did not survive. In a month-long trial at the Old Bailey, on the 30th of June 2008, 21-year-old Maria, whose fingerprints had proven that she was solely responsible for the attack on Eduardo, admitted to his murder and pleaded guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. She was given an indefinite prison sentence, with Judge Morris insisting that she serve a minimum of 3 years. Cleared of both the charges of murder and manslaughter, Richard and Ricardo wept as they were released. And as for the rape and sexual assault allegations made by Maria against Eduardo, they remain unresolved. But was Uncle Eduardo's murder a case of revenge or blind obsession? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. As always, if you enjoy listening to the pendulous jowls of a cake-filled fat man as he waffles on about his stupid little life in which pretty much nothing happens, except his imaginary relationship with the goddess Eva Green. Stay tuned till after the break for more info and a little quiz in Extra Mile. If you're up to date and you've run out of episodes of Murder Mile, just to say there are 50 episodes of Walk With Me, the companion piece to Murder Mile, available via Patreon. as well as location videos and exclusive photos for more than 100 episodes, as well as our regular feature, Cake of the Week.
Yum!
You can become a Patreon subscriber for as little as $3 a month. That's £2 in real money. And I'll also post you a very exclusive pack of goodies and a handwritten thank you card from me. Life can't get any better than that. And of course, if you fancy a Murder Mile mug of goodies, you can order one via the Murder Mile merch shop. Murder Mile was research written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Getting better at that. Getting better. Whew. Wasn't as many mistakes as normal, which is a miracle. It's weird. When I started this out, like, an episode would take absolutely hours to really record, just because I'd stutter and stumble over every word. It doesn't help having a bit of a slight speech impediment and have dyslexia as well. But I think doing the podcasting has really helped. It's really helped sort all this out, and hence I can kind of power through. Also, I try not to over egg the episodes by putting too many too much alliteration there, because even though they're fun to say, sometimes it takes me minutes and it gets really frustrating. And oh, hello everyone, welcome to Extra Mile. Whew, we're back. You can hear Coot in the background shouting his mouth off. There's a duck not too far down from here, and he's really annoying. And he does this, he just goes, meh, 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 and he doesn't stop for an hour. And then he'll stop for like a minute, because he gives himself a bit of a breath, and he goes, meh, 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 and he just keeps going. It's like, shut up, you little bastard. Right. Let me go and make a disgustingly cheap cup of tea. I'd already done the water. I'm just going to open some curtains as well. Cool, look, daylight. Yay! Open up these curtains as well. Pop that on. Oh, look. Cheapy tea. Cheapy coffee. And it's as always, it's roulette coffee, where I put it in a big jar, I get it down to about quarter empty, and then I refill it with another coffee, then I give it a stir, then I do it again. And then you end up with what can be called as quite an interesting little coffee. It's you get hints of it. Sometimes it can be a bit weak, and then you get a blast of it, where like some super strength coffee is in there. Oh! Anyway, heading back. Oh! So what's going on? I was heading into town. Unfortunately, they're fixing one of the locks. And I said to the people who run the canal authority, I said to them, what do I do? Because I've missed the deadline to get through the lock. My mistake. What do I do? Can I stay here for like 5 weeks? And they went, no, you've got to turn around and go back. And then when the lock opens, then you can continue your journey. So basically, I'm back where I was two weeks ago, which is really annoying. But it's fine, actually, because I was kind of hoping they'd say that. They'd say, you've got to turn around. So I've turned back, and I'm near the Good Bakery. I'm near a laundrette. I'm near a place where there's lots of nice walks I can take. It's actually, I'm not really that bothered, to be honest. If I would have stayed there, I was right next to the HS2 site, and all you could hear was the boom, boom, boom all the time. So yeah, I'm not really that bothered about that. What else is going on? I'm still researching the Murder Mile book, hoping to get that out next summer. That's proving fun. Just focusing on all cases in and around Old Compton Street, which is good fun. And finding a lot of cases that have never been covered before. Just because I have different ways of researching things. And they're all good, so we will be, so you'll get a book, it'll be all based on one street, and you'll be able to see all these cases, read all these cases that you never heard before. But even with the cases that we have covered on Murder Mile before, I found new spins on it. It's very, really a lot of fun. I've had a lot of really good fun days where I've picked up old cases and thought, okay, let's pretend I don't know anything about this case, and then I've researched in and gone, ooh, this is a new angle that I've never thought of before. So yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with those, and just a lot of stuff that I just never knew about as well. So but that won't be out until probably summertime. What else is going on? Evenings, I've started making nice a litre of ramen for dinner. I do a big walk, like I did 10 miles yesterday, which was good fun. Burn off all my calories because I'm sitting down all day. And then in the evening, I get like a big mixing bowl out, and I make a handmade ramen with it. I put in all my ginger and me garlic, and you know all the stuff that you put in. And the great thing with ramen, you can put any old crap in it, and it's, oh god, it's great. But it's like, it's a liter deep in a big bowl. Here's my coffee. It's ready. Coffee ready. There we go. Coming back. Yeah, it's lovely. So you put all your garlic and your ginger in it, and your spring onions, and your pak choi, and the great thing is, you put carrots and everything in it, and it's just great. And then your noodles in, it's really brothy, and you sit there for an hour and you drink the broth, and the broth has got all, because it's got all the chili in it. Oh, it's nice. It makes you all nice and warm. So that's my evening treat. I've had the fire on for a couple of days, but it's too warm now. It's 10 degrees at night outside, and I keep waking up in the middle of the night going, God, it's too bloody hot. Oh, I'm dying. It's all right for Eva. She likes the heat. But me, you know, I have to sit at the end of the bed at her feet, making whimpering sounds. She likes it when I make whimpering sounds like a little puppy. But no, the ramen's good. Very good. Eating my ramen whilst enjoying, I'm really getting into what's it, SAS, Are You Tough Enough? The thing with Ant Middleton. Quite enjoying that. That's really good fun. Good series. I tried watching, what's that one? Forensic show with Professor, whatever his name is, who makes the wild assumptions, and Amelia Fox. God, that's contrived. Oh, God. Unfortunately, having spent so many years in television, unfortunately, I can see all the contrivances in it and the contrived conversations that they have. Like, oh, I've just received a call from... And it's just like, no, you haven't. This has all been done by the researchers months ago. This is all pre-done in advance, but it's made to make you think, oh, it's just the two of them. It's not... They're not doing... They're doing frick all. Oh, God, it's so contrived. Oh... And when they're having the conversations, it's clearly scripted, and you can tell because Amelia's good at having a conversation, but Professor whatever his name is, let's just call him Professor Knobhead. Professor David Wilson is his name. he's not very good at acting, unfortunately, and therefore it comes across awkwardly. Anyway, luckily I've got other... I don't really like true crime programmes. I find them really contrived. I really do. What else is going on? News, I'm not doing CrimeCon next year. Had a good long talk. I really enjoyed it this year just gone. Really lovely to kind of meet up with all the podcasters and have a good laugh, and that was really good. But personally for me, I just don't feel it was beneficial for me as a podcaster. It costs a lot of money to do. It costs a lot to turn up. It was lovely to meet a lot of people there. It was really good. But I just didn't feel it was as beneficial as it could be, given the amount of money that it costs for us to do it, and you've got to take time off as well. So I won't be doing that next year, which is good news for you guys. That means I won't be doing any adverts, any of those annoying bloody adverts across a year. But I will be doing some lovely free meet and greets with some of the other podcasters, because I know some of the others aren't doing it as well. So we're going to do free meetups, meet and greets, different parts of the country, hopefully. Turn up, say hello to us. We'll bring some freebies with us. We'll have some giggle, maybe do a quiz, maybe do some live podcasting. Who knows? So have a bit of giggle at that. So stay tuned. No details at the moment, but stay tuned. At the time of recording, iTunes are still being a bloody pain in the arse. And I'm still struggling to get episode 149, The Abuse of Jane Andrews, part 2, uploaded. It is in there. If you're an iTunes subscriber, if you look at the main window, it's not there. You'll go, oh, where is it? Where's the episode? But if you're a subscriber, go into where it says your podcast feed. And it is in there, because I subscribe to it, and it is in there. It's just not showing up in the window. So, but if not, say balls to iTunes. iTunes is a piece of shit, and they keep updating it all the time, and it always goes wrong, and there's no one you can talk to, and they're just wankers. I hate them. They really are an unnecessary, unfortunately, a necessary evil. I'm pretty much on every podcast platform, so if you want to do what I do, have a secondary backup one. I have Podcast Addict, and I have a couple of other ones. I upload direct to Acast. They have a podcast app. It's always going to be on that, so you can have that as a backup if you need to. You don't need to subscribe to that. You can just listen to the episode when you need to. Or, of course, if you're a subscriber to Patreon, oh, lovely. If you pay, I think it's more than, I think it's like $10 a month, which is £7 or something like that. On the tier above that, you get the episodes every single week without fail, no adverts, none of that shit, and it always arrives on a Monday. Brilliant. You get it 3 days before everyone else, so very much worth doing. Cake of the week. Well, my cake of the week is a Belgian bun. I'm near the little bakery around the corner. I've got a big old Belgian bun. Oh, it's stuck to the wrapper. And there he is. There's the little glacé cherry, which I'll eat last. Right. Let's do the quiz questions. Oh, quick slurp of the coffee and it was too hot. Question number one. What country was Maria born in? This was a really awkward episode to do because I can't pronounce my R's properly, and therefore I've got Maria, Richard, and Ricardo. And there's lots of other stuff as well. It made it really difficult. Could be worse. Could be more difficult names. Question two: what did Maria's father do as a job? Question three: what bridge did Maria's mother jump from? Which, if you Google this bridge, it comes up with all the wrong bridges. That's fascinating. Google it and then click on images, and you'll only see like a handful of that bridge, and often they point to the wrong bridge. Bloody Google. Question four. What is the name of the police team who deal with sexual assault? That was mentioned at the end of the episode. Although, I may have deleted the bit where I said that they deal solely with sexual assault, only because it was proving a bit of a mouthful of a sentence. That may be edited out. Question five. What was Maria's middle name? Question six. How many times was Eduardo stabbed? Question seven. What ages were Eduardo's boys at the time of the murder? Question eight. A minimum of how many years must Maria spend in prison? Question nine. What was Maria known as in the mental health report? And question 10, what year did Maria and her family come to the UK? There you go. We'll do some extra stuff on this. So as mentioned in this episode, it's a hard one to kind of do. Very little of it made it into the press. Barely any of it made it into television. I think there's only like about five news outlets who picked it up, and all of them had the same kind of information from the from either Reuters or AP Wire. There was probably about two paragraphs in total, and I remember looking at it and going, well, this could be a really interesting case, but I wish I had more details. But because I know where to look and how to look and how to dive into deep into cases, I knew that there would be a mental health report. I just had to find it. And I found it. It took a while. But then when you get inside there, the problem with the report is they make reference to Miss X and Mr. B and things like that. And you go, oh, shit, who are all these people? But luckily, there's not too many people in this case. And when they go, Miss X's daughter, you can go, okay, right. You can start making the links. So luckily, I used that. That was the primary basis for this. So you probably won't hear this. You probably almost certainly won't hear this case anywhere else, because I think most people will look at it and go, there's not enough information, but there is. You've just got to dig deep. So, the hereditary blindness condition, it was retinitis pigmentosa, which is a rare group of genetic disorders that involve the breakdown and loss of cells in the retina, which is the light-sensitive tissue at the back of the eye. Common symptoms include difficulty seeing at night and loss of peripheral vision. In the early stages of RP, rods are more severely affected than cones. As the rods die, people experience night blindness and progressive loss of the field of vision. The area of space... many people start developing tunnel vision, but it's quite an aggressive degeneration, and it gets to the point where it's almost, in many cases, almost entire blindness. So with Maria, her father got it first, as mentioned, in 1998. So he was told that he would be almost entirely blind within a year. So by the time the murder happened, he was entirely blind, almost as near entirely blind, which meant he had to be kind of walked everywhere. Maria was diagnosed in 2005, initially with glaucoma, but then 2006, she was given diagnosis of the condition of RP in 2006, which meant by the time that the murder happened, she was almost entirely blind as well. Her brother, maybe not, we don't have clarification of this, he seems to have had it as well, and may have been diagnosed a year after her, but again, question mark. There's a lot of information in the mental health file, but obviously it's focused on her mental health, not entirely on the case. So there's a lot of details that are kind of hard to pin down. I think what's really interesting about this case is the relationship between Maria and Eduardo. What really was going on there? Was he an abusive uncle? Did he have her under his kind of power and control? Because she didn't find a lot of love in her family, was it the fact that he was abusing her? Did she see that as some kind of love, as quite often happens? Do you know, there's kind of a weird line between, am I being loved or am I being abused? And some people sometimes see abuse and love as the same thing. They're like, you know, I would at least this person is kissing me and touching me, and they see that as kind of nicer than being physically assaulted, or you know, your mum trying to kill you or drown you in your bath or throwing you off a bridge, you know. So it makes for a really complicated situation. As far as we know, the allegations against the uncle remain unsolved. I've searched, I haven't been able to find any reports on this. Maybe because he's dead, maybe they have been left unresolved, we don't know. It's an interesting case in a way, because the parents both accused the uncle of raping their daughter, The daughter Maria denies this, but she also says it did happen as well. So that's hard to kind of pin down. The uncle's own daughter said that there was sexual abuse taking place. But in the report as well, it also says that there's sexual abuse committed by the sons of the uncle as well. Although a lot of this is allegation. So it's... This is a really hard... This was a pig to write in a way, because there's a lot of stuff in here that isn't provable. The facts of the murder are there. They're solid. Even though we haven't kind of got the police reports not there and things like that. But the details are solid enough. Whereas the allegations of abuse, this is the kind of hard thing, is that people would make accusations and then they would deny the accusation, do you know? So it's a really hard one. There was accusations on all sides. So Hammersmith and Fulham, a single agency review, identifies that at various times there were allegations of bullying, domestic violence and poor parenting. Both Maria and her brother remained on the Child Protection Register for 4 years. They were in the care of the local authority for 11 years, during which time they lived mainly with their parents, with some periods in foster care. But also, as you've seen in this episode, Maria had a tendency to go back to her uncle, which makes for a very interesting and difficult situation, which is why at the end I kind of posed the question, really, what is going on here? Why did she kill him? Was it... See, he seems to abuse her, if he indeed he did abuse her, but then she goes back to him, which we see a lot in a lot of different cases, where, especially with domestic violence cases, where, you know, someone will be beaten and abused and everyone's going, you've got to get out of the relationship. And the man or the woman goes, yeah, but I love them. I love them. I can't live without them, because they're made to feel so worthless. And it's uncertain whether this is kind of the same thing here, whether her mum made her feel so worthless. As she said at the start, you know, my spit is not worth anything. So maybe having the uncle kind of, in her eyes, not abuse her, but kind of give her love and kind of, you know, kissing and cuddling and things like that, and etc., and a sexual relationship. Maybe she saw that as as proper love, how love is meant to be. It's as they say, you know, when you're a kid, how do you know the difference from right and wrong? How does she, as a child, if she's raised in that kind of environment where she's being abused on one end and she doesn't, how does she not see that it's not abuse on the other end? It's a weird situation. There's a lot of mistakes made by Hammersmith and Fulham social services in this case. A lot of opportunities were missed. I won't go into them all. I've tried to pick up a lot of points in this episode, but there's a lot that we just can't verify. It's a very difficult one. The second possible allegation made by the uncle's daughter in July 2001, where she came back home and found Uncle Eduardo on the sofa, shirtless and putting on his trousers next to Maria. That's all we really know about that. It's very vague on there. We don't have a police report about that. We probably never will do. So exactly what happened there, it's hard to pin down. As mentioned, September 2004, that's when she turned 18. So she was no longer under the care of Hammersmith and Fulham's Children's Services. But they saw that she had very complex mental health needs, so she was transferred under the Adult Mental Health Services Department. She was given an enhanced care package. She was allocated a care coordinator who worked with her leaving care team worker for several years. They had apparently a very close relationship, but the care worker was not trained or experienced in mental health. The mental health assessment. So the mental health team assessed her on a regular basis. She was always an outpatient. She was assessed and diagnosed with moderate to severe anxiety, although the consultant found there was no evidence of major mental illness and no medication was required at that point. She was referred to the Trust Psychological Services for cognitive behavioural therapy. As mentioned throughout, they said she had an adjustment disorder, which is a stress-related short-term non-psychotic disturbance with dissociative symptoms, which is depersonalization. So a feeling that your body does not quite belong to you or is disconnected from you, and a feeling that you are not connected to the world around you, that you're constantly spaced out, combined with the fact that she also had agoraphobia, which, as you know, is they've got it here, is an anxiety disorder characterized by anxiety in situations where it is perceived to be difficult or embarrassing to escape. Mentioned in here as well that she seemed to be suffering, it's hallucinations, but they describe it as pseudo hallucinations. So pseudo hallucinations, the difference is a hallucination is you're seeing something and you believe it's real, but a pseudo hallucination is you're hallucinating, but you know it's a hallucination. So you know it's not real, but you can see it. And she was aware of the fact that she was seeing things that weren't real, but they were just in her head, but she could physically see them. She was feeling suicidal at the same time, which is exactly the same as her mother previously. We don't know what her mother suffered from. That's not mentioned in here. It said that she was emotionally unstable and impulsive. She had low self-esteem and social anxiety. Threats to her. I'm going to have another slurp of my disgustingly cheap coffee. Oh, lovely. October 2007, as mentioned, she'd threatened violence towards her uncle. She'd threatened violence to her mother prior. This is around the point where she's denying that any abuse has taken place, but again, she'd sometimes slip back into it. It's uncertain exactly what is going on by this point. Whether her uncle had kind of wasn't interested in her anymore, or because she was making accusations against him, he was like, I don't want you around my flat anymore, I don't want you here, you're causing me problems. So that's when she'd started making threats to stab him, but also to blind him. We don't know much about the murder itself. We know that she stabbed him number of times, which is one of the quiz questions. Well done, Michael. We don't know where the stab wounds happened. It could be that he was stabbed in the eyes, because as we see here that she wanted to blind him, but we don't know. We don't know exactly whether it's full-on stab wounds or whether it's slashes, but as mentioned, it took place over 24 minutes, which is a hell of a long time. It's roughly, she stabbed him once every 15 seconds, roughly, during that period of time. But we don't know anything about it. But literally, because it wasn't really that relevant to her mental health case, kind of because the report itself was really about her history and where the council and social services felt that they may have made a mistake or whatever. It's focused on that. So the murder itself is kind of really just a cherry on the cake, really. Cherry on the cake, which I'm about to tuck into very shortly. She had a couple of meetings with her psychiatrist during as things were going downhill. She had one on the 12th of December 2006. Her thoughts were plagued with the idea that she was going blind. Her eyesight was continually disappearing. She was very agoraphobic by that point, and she wanted to die. She was offered an inpatient admission, but the offer made her more agitated. She said she would rather go home with her uncle, who had accompanied her to the appointment. So even though she's making accusations against him, she still wants to live with her uncle, and he comes with her to the appointment. Obviously, that also could be the fact that because she is going blind, she needs someone to accompany her there. And her uncle was one of the people that she trusted. So it's an interesting situation. Also with her father as well. She seems to... There doesn't seem to be anything bad said against her father at all. He seems to be, you know, quite a good, decent man, a provider, things like that. But obviously she's got a really, really turbulent relationship with her mother. And her mother is still living there. So whether if the mother wasn't there, whether she would have lived with her father instead, we don't know. obviously in this episode, I don't really say much about the brother Richard, because all this information comes from the mental health report of Maria, not Richard. So we don't really know much about him. I don't really say much about him in here. There was a crisis resolution meeting set up in January 2007. A Protection of Vulnerable Adults meeting. It took place 23rd of January 2007, attended by all the psychiatrists, the social workers, the care coordinator. Their plan was for Maria to be referred to a low support housing unit and for the leaving care team to stop their involvement with her when she became 21 years old, which would be September 2007, which is 3 months after the murder happened. So they would still be supporting her by that point. She was deteriorating fast. She said she was hearing voices in the middle of the night, and she, in the morning, she would see a woman who she would sometimes see as well as hear. At that point, she was prescribed the antipsychotic risperidone. What else was there? Things were deteriorating at home. 14th of March, she said to her, she'd stopped going to a lot of her appointments, but she'd said to one of her counsellors that she'd recently had an argument with her uncle. She was throwing things at him, but not directly attacking him. What else was there? And I think this is the key one. 2 days before, this is the key incident, I think so. She said that her uncle had been winding her up by saying that he was going to bring her daughter to his own daughter from England, from Peru, in her words, to make her life hell. I just felt rage and I stabbed him in the back with a knife. It's an odd one. It seems to be jealousy, rejection, upset, all the stuff to do with the physical assaults and the sexual allegations have always been there for the last 7 years, but this seems to be the tipping point. This seems to be the point where everything just snaps inside her. She doesn't go back home with him. She goes back to her parents. Obviously, as mentioned, he covers for her, but she reiterates the rape allegation to the police. But unfortunately, with the police, what they did, she obviously went to Hammersmith Police Station. She made an accusation of the fact that she had stabbed him and that he had raped her in 2000. So obviously, because this is two separate offences, it had to be split. So one team would deal with the stabbing and the other would deal with the rape allegation. Obviously, that went to the specialist unit who deals with the rape allegations. Unfortunately, the police were so focused on the rape allegation that they really hadn't focused on the fact that she had stabbed him. And in the court, Judge Morris, he said if there would have been more of a focus at that point of why she had committed that stabbing, maybe the murder would never have taken place. I mean, it's all hindsight, isn't it? You can say that about anything. Maria had returned to her father's home. She had previously told the care worker and the leaving social worker that she feels safe there. The coordinator reported the matter to one of the mental health senior practitioners, who sought advice from the doctor, who offered Maria an urgent review appointment on Monday the 18th of June. Sadly, this was 1 day after the murder. Always the way with these things, you know. People try their best, but you can't predict when someone's going to go over the edge. Maria was taken to Shepherd's Bush Police Station, and the doctor said that she was under the influence of auditory hallucinations. She seemed distressed when the duty mental health approved social worker saw her and asked about events earlier that morning. Maria described seeing another version of herself entering and leaving the police cell, and at times appeared to be engaging in a conversation with this other version of herself. Maria was placed on Section 2 of the Mental Health Act and transferred to a private mental hospital. We really don't know much about her at that point, because afterwards she was transferred to... when she was convicted, she was transferred to prison. We don't know anything else about where she is now, what she's up to. she could be released, as far as we know. Let's do the quiz questions and then we can answer some of those extra stuff. There we go. Okay. Right. Oh, come on, Michael. Find that page. There we go. Michael. Okay, question number one. What country was Maria born in? It was Peru. Question number two. What did Maria's father do as a job? He was a dental assistant. What bridge did Maria's mother jump from? It was London Bridge. What is the name of the police team who deal with sexual assault? I may have edited this out. The Sapphire Team. Question five. What was Maria's middle name? That was a trick question. She doesn't have one, I think. There wasn't one mentioned in the report, so, but she may have one. But as far as we know, we don't. So that's the answer. Question six. How many times was Eduardo stabbed? It was 111 times. Cripes. But obviously we don't know whether that was... whether it was repeated stabs, like repeatedly in the last couple of minutes of the murder, just her ferociously stabbing him, or whether she did it over those full 24 minutes. We don't know. Question seven. What ages were Eduardo's boys at the time of the murder? They were 12 and 13. Question eight. A minimum of how many years must Maria spend in prison? It was three. The minimum, she was given an indefinite sentence, but a minimum of three. So she could be out now, for as far as we know. Question nine. What was Maria known as in the mental health report? It was Ms. T. Ooh, T. Lummy. And question 10. What year did Maria and her family come to the UK? It was 1992. Oh, so that's that. That's all done. Hope you enjoyed that. We got five more episodes of Murder Mile to go until the end, to take us through to the end of the year. I might do a little special thingy for Christmas Day, and then I might do something special for New Year. And then, don't forget, that takes us to January and February, which is when I take off because I do all the research. So that'll be nice and quiet. And then we'll be back in March. So thank you very much for listening to Murder Mile. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.